podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Don't Nearly View system, Diogo. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
So it's a longer, more relaxed chat with Pat about his book, Pat Nevin, his book, The Accidental Footballer. It's a pleasure to chat to you about it, Pat. I haven't finished it just this morning. Mm-hmm. There's loads of little bits and pieces. For me, that you very much adopted very early in life this mentality that everything you were doing, you are opting into. And I think there's a little wobble, and it's interesting through the text when you find yourself the night that Annabelle gives birth, you go home and you feel as though there's greater responsibilities now. But up to that point, it seems to me as though, in a really clear way, no was always a valid answer from you. I will always feel as though if I just want to say no to something, I'm just going to say no to something. You would always have the idea, therefore, that anything you were doing, because you'd chosen to do it, you were doing it with full gusto. You were doing it because you wanted to do it. And if anything, that should be the reason why they should see this idea that you have an ability to say no, that the yeses mean more. Is that fair?
Yeah, there definitely is something in that. And as you ask the question like that, this is not a great sale for the book. It reminds me of something, it reminds me of something I took out. And it's interesting because there's a piece in the book where a photographer comes and asks me to dress up in a top hat and a stick. And it was because I'm an Anglo-Scottish person. And I basically said, get lost, or said, I know someone else will do it. And I went and asked Brian McClure to come down, and he came down and gave the guy a volley of abuse. Because that's the sort of thing that we would do. But I actually remember when I was about 15 or 16 and a photographer came round to the house. And he said, we need a photograph for I was doing well at Celtic Boys Club at the time. And I said, we'll take a photograph. And he said, well, do you do anything else apart from it? And I said, well, I'll play clarinet with a school band. I'll do this, I'll do that. And he goes, oh, right, here's a recorder. Take a picture of you. And I went, really? I don't play recorder. And he goes, well, I was only about 15. And I went, oh, all right. And I took a bit. I hated myself for years for doing that tiny wee moment at 15. Of, no, don't do that. Isn't that stupid? And I learned a massive thing. And every now and again, you'll do things that are wrong, but as long as you learn from them. So that no isn't a... I would say I say yes to the vast majority of things anyone asks me. I mean, you've asked for an interview and I'll say, yeah, all right, we'll have a chat. I'm cool that way. But if you're Sky TV and you want to do something that I don't like the idea of it, and you want to pay me a lot of money, I don't care. I'm not going to do it. Because it's not about that. It's doing what are, I feel, the right things. So, yeah, no, it makes me sound a wee bit Ian Paisley, but I'm not. No, absolutely not. I'm very much a yes, but only on my terms. And I think that's the point I'm making.
That is the point I'm making. But I think that in the world of football as it was then, I would be intrigued to know the whys and whys if it's a little bit different now around the way in which footballers are treated. But as it was then, it was very much you're part of this big gang. There's a fella who's in charge. He does what you tell him. But also this belief that you'll have the same wants and needs as everyone else. You know, in the book, you refer to the fact that in your contract negotiation with Ken Bates at Chelsea, one of the things that you inserted in was that for a pre-season friendly, could you be subbed at halftime so you could get off in time to go and see New Order? Mm-hmm. You know, this sort of stuff, it is unique to certainly the way football was. And it is but it is within it. And I think this is the bit that people miss when you talk about knowing your own mind, is that knowing your own mind when you're doing what you want to do is a massive positive. You play football the way you wanted to play it because you loved it. You're part of these teams because you wanted to be. You played for those managers because you'd chosen that. And that's the thing that comes through over and over again in the book. What you said to Colin Harvey when he dropped you is one of the sweetest things I've ever read. And you're saying it because you the respect that you had for him in that moment. But the point is that's underpinned by the idea of, if you don't like this, I'd just be saying no anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's the way this works.
Yeah, I'm happy you picked up on that, because various people I've talked to about the book, they settle on different things. That was a very, very, very important moment, is to explain to people, you know, you can be an individualist, which I was in many ways in the field, but that doesn't stop you being a great team player. You know, working your socks off for the team and also self-sacrificing for the group if you need to do it at the right time. For me, that's ingrained in my body, in my personality, in my spirit of, and that doesn't matter if it's football or friends or politics, it doesn't matter. You do what is for the good of, you know, your close society or the bigger society. So that seems like quite a grand idea. And my problem halfway through most of this book was thinking, right, okay, I was really earnest when I was younger, right? Okay, I'll give you this, almost called the book The Importance of Not Being Earnest. And what you're talking about just now underlines it, doesn't it? Because if you sound like that and you're like that all the time, you're on a pedestal all the time, you know, you get it in Liverpool, you used to get it in Glasgow all the time. There's a lot of guys, usually from the far left, that stand in the soapbox and they're shouting and bawling and screaming at you, and you do get bored after a while. And you get a bit fed up and you think, where's the jokes? You know, or where's the lightness? Where's the fun in life? You need to remember that. And I was a wee bit, when I was younger, I had that earnestness. But you can still have a really, hopefully, quite pure attitude, but also dump some of the earnestness as well. And that's kind of one of the travels that I was actually going down. But yeah, it is a big part of the book. But I wouldn't want anyone to think they're going to have to wade through a book with this earnestness, because it really isn't like that. Very specifically, can I tell you a wee story of why it's not like that? As I've been thinking of writing it for a wee while, and I read a book about 4 or 5 years ago, I read a lot, and it just dawned on me that the subject matter of this book was so dark. It was about people dying in hospital. It was it's by Adam Kay. I don't know if you've read it or any of the listeners have read it. It's called This Is Going to Hurt. But it was the funniest book I've read since Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And it's about the darkest of subjects and what he was going through and the nightmare of all that. And I'm thinking, that's kind of me. There's a lot of serious things around, but for goodness sake, you know, none of us are going to get out of this alive. Like, you know, so we might as well enjoy it while we're here. And that was kind of, and he had one other thing, he had a technical thing. Now, I will own up when I steal something, hands up, I own up to it. There is a difficulty, and it's a Gaelic thing. And, you know, see the comedians that a lot of people, myself, like Billy Connolly, I'll tell you a story, and then you go over there and tell something else for about 15 minutes, then you come back again. See, writing that in a book, really hard, right? It's really, really hard, right? Because people go, what? You went over, what? But this guy, Adam Kay, he just had huge notes at the bottom. So you could sidle off into these big, long notes and read a story there and then come back in again. So I stole that idea. So you'll notice that in the long path, and a number of people said to me, they love those notes. And I thought at the start they were a wee bit of a cop-out, because you should, you know, like with Jane Austen, you should make sure it flows together, you know. Actually, so I thought, it's for the reader to enjoy. So I kind of did that, and I love that side of it as well.
No, the fact that you're enjoying the act of writing, I think is absolutely brilliant all the way through. It's quite clear that you're enjoying writing the book. You're enjoying going back into those worlds. Mm. And it's clear how the enjoyment of the life as it was being lived sort of pops over as well. You know, these odd nights before games when you're in gigs in London is something which, you know, now is almost difficult to conceive of because of how we conceive of footballers' lives. But it was how you were effectively, as was said in there, you know, it's almost your pre-game prep was, I'm going to go and have this excellent night. I'm not going to be worrying about tomorrow. I'll deal with tomorrow. And then when tomorrow comes, I'm going to enjoy my football. So I'm enjoying tonight and then I'm enjoying tomorrow. It's a book that's got about some of the most enjoyments of someone being alive, being in certain situations, not complaining about moving on and off of couches, instead thinking, well, it's great that we moved to this gaff and there was fleas in the carpet, but I didn't care. I was over there. But oh, you're a professional footballer. I don't care about that. And that's all the way through, you captured that sort of sense of yourself as 2021, being in London, being at Chelsea, having the great times on the pitch, but also having the great times off them.
And the weird thing is, I haven't changed. Same way, because my life went on and had various other things afterwards. And I just felt it was a really nice attitude if you can go through life being as happy. I mean, there are tough times, and there are times where you're desperately sad. And I mean, even just, there was one piece, I have to be honest about it, I took a long time writing about Hillsborough. And, you know, obviously I played in the other semi-final, I scored the winner in the other semi-final. And then we found out right after the game. And writing about what we felt, what we thought after that I put more time into those pages than I did everything else put together. Because yeah. I was never going to offend it. And obviously, almost I couldn't, because I was so impressed by the way the people of Liverpool behaved and the dignity and the strength and all that. But reading that back, and I did read that back quite recently again, and just thought, I'm happy that was I did that right. I didn't try and throw in a joke or anything like that, because there was no jokes then. There was no fun then. There was no joy then. It was just the darkest, bleakest period. But the only thing in the midst of it all was, and I don't know if you remember reading it, going to some of the funerals.
Yep.
And the singing, I'm going to have to stop for a minute. You know, singing "You'll Never Walk Alone" at the end of it, of every one of them. My back was, you know, it's right now my back's creeping, of spine tingling, of the beauty and the dignity of the people and the sadness of it all. So, you know, having to write what I want to be a fun, lighthearted book, but you couldn't ignore and didn't want to ignore the other sides of life as well. But in the end, you know, we got through it. A lot of people didn't get through it. And you have to always put that on board. So I'll say I can have a joyous, fun life. I also know I'm damn lucky. In fact, no, also know, I know above all, I'm damn lucky.
The idea of, you mentioned that Liverpool, obviously Glasgow, and then within there, London as well. To me, you know, London, I love the line of your mother thinking of it as a den of iniquity at all stages. So when you go down, she thinks of it as a den of iniquity. You're like, oh. But there are three cities that do, and London sort of surprises people at this at times, but London's also a dock city. It's a port city. It's a city of immigration. It's a city where there's a lot of different mindsets. There's a strong, you mentioned the Caledonian almost welcome that you can get down there from people who move around. There are three cities with a lot in common. And the title of the book is The Accidental Footballer. Somewhere psychologically, I don't think it's any accident that Pat Nevin plays his football in Glasgow, Liverpool and London. I don't think that's any accident whatsoever. You know, you're not dipping off and playing for Reading. You're not getting a few games at Oxford United. It seems to me to be, you know, that I think there's something there that Glasgow, Liverpool and London, it feels as though it was almost meant to be.
I felt comfortable. And, you know, all the time that, and not just the actual cities, but in the environs as well. I mean, I had the choice between Istanbul and the Whittle, you know. And I choose the world because I just love the area. I love people. It's right. The football, the purity of it all. Yeah, it sounds, I made a lot of decisions throughout my career and my life that people think were really, really strange. But from my point of view, absolutely not. And part of it was, yeah, I feel at home in Glasgow. I feel at home in, you know, certain cities. I've grown to love others. And in actual fact, I am a complete and utterly dedicated traveller. I love travelling, which has been hell for me, obviously, the last 2 years, as it has been for everybody else. But I would never go to a city and think, oh, I don't like this. I go to a city and say, right, what can I find out? What is the heart of the city? What are the bits of the city that are interesting, different, surprising? And that you could find that. And to be fair, you could find bits of that in Manchester. You can find, well, we lived in Chester while I was there, because to be honest, living in the heart of Liverpool, when you play for Liverpool or Everton, it's impossible. If you want to be normal, and I want to be normal, right? So that was impossible. But coming into the cities and feeling comfortable, and also understanding the attitude. To say at one point, I'm sure it's in the book, about my thanks to the people, to the Scousers, basically. It's just saying, my dad used to come down every week, and he absolutely loved arriving at Lime Street. Because you just talk to people and you go to the game and you get a bus up. And it was like, he felt it was like exactly like Glasgow. Like, if you go on a bus in Glasgow, you can speak to people. If you're actually on a bus in Liverpool, you can still, you'll end up chatting to somebody if you want it, right? You try that on a tube in London. Like, okay, so it's not going to quite be the same. But if you dig deep enough in places like London, you can still feel that camaraderie. So the cities were, it's a good point. this broke up into three parts. It is Glasgow, it is London, and then it is Liverpool.
The other thing that's a constant companion through this is music. You, in fact, have a chapter titles playlist at the very end. I was wondering if you might actually have a playlist of a wide variety of bands that are mentioned all the way through. This morning, whilst I was finishing off reading the book, I decided to throw some Cocteau Twins on myself. I was enjoying that massively. This also comes through in the hero worship followed by friendship with John Peel. I don't know if you remember, you were at a Dutch music festival with John around 2001, I'm going to say.
It's good luck me remembering.
Because I remember it was one of the most fantastic hours of radio I've ever heard. And the reason why was because it was you and John, but John hadn't brought enough records because he thought that they had more access to the band's tunes at the festival, so he didn't think he'd have that many. So it was a lot of just you and John chatting in this way that was showed that you were old friends. But you wanted to talk to John about music and John just wanted to talk to you about football. Awesome. And I was wondering if that was the way, was that the way it was every single time you saw him?
Not every single time, but yeah, that was quite common. But John did love his music, absolutely dearly loved the music as well. So he was desperately keen, like all of us who are really mad keen music lovers, for the actual music as opposed to, you know, being seen to like a certain thing. Or if you really are into it, the thing, you enjoy the listening, you enjoy the live experience. But let's be fair, one of the best bits is saying to your mates, you've not heard this yet, you've got to hear this, and giving them it, right? And then watching it and listening and them getting back to you. John was just like that all the time. Like, hey, you've got to hear this, you've got to hear this. I'm going to play this. This is brilliant. This is right down your street, or else you might hate this, which immediately you think, right, okay, we'll see about that. and I kind of loved it. John was a difficult one because I could have written five chapters about the things, the fun times, the places we met, the things that happened when we were there. But it was best just to actually encapsulate it in moments to explain why. Like, he was, if I hero worshipped anyone, it was him before I went to London, and then we become mates, and then I'd go on the show, and then we go for curries and things like that. And, you know, and there's another story in the book I've just finished writing, which is the next one, which is about John, which honestly, you'll struggle not to cry when you read it. It's amazing. But one of my favourite moments ever is, I didn't even see him. And it was, well, two favourite moments. I scored against Liverpool at Anfield. And he's giving me dog's abuse on the Monday night show. And I was like, I was so happy with that. I was really, really pleased with that. And the other one is, I got him tickets for the FA Cup final 89. And him and Sheila came along. But I didn't see them. I'm playing, obviously. And then everyone tell me afterwards that it was head to toe in red and white and among all the blues. And I think, yeah, that's John. Absolutely, that's John. But it's really, it was fantastic to, I think, underline that we were similar in so many ways. And the similarity was, we were both in the industries that we loved, but we didn't love all the accoutrements of the industry.
Yeah.
We didn't like the fame. We didn't do it so that we could influence people and be noticed and all that. We do it because we had a pure love of the art. And I would call the football the art, as well as the music being the art. And we were seen as complete outsiders within our sphere. So it sounds, from the outsider's point of view, that, well, how come you two are mates? In actual fact, the similarities were ridiculous. So yeah, we talk about football, music, films, you name it. Just look, two mates, you know? That's what mates do, isn't it?
That's again what comes over. But within all of this, your friendships, I think, through this period of your life become really important to you. I thought it was you know, but again in a way that's not typical of footballers, but instead, you know, almost this strange sense where I can imagine that, you know, with some of your groups of friends, you were like Pat, who's got this slightly odd job. We don't really talk much about Pat's job. We'll talk about the stuff that we're doing here, and that I think is something which in a different way would be harder now because of the huge amounts of money, but I think that now football.
Can I stop you? I'm not giving them that.
Go on.
They keep on telling us that it's hard on them. I mean, really? You're getting paid all sorts of stupid money. if you want to not get noticed, you go down and see things that people aren't going to bother. If you go down to the theatre, if you go down to the, you know, cinemas, you can actually go and do it quietly. There's very, very few. I mean, apart for Ronaldo or whoever, you know. And there's also, there's a bargain. And there absolutely is a bargain. If you are going to spend your time, you know, trying to make yourself really well known, because you don't need to be, you just need to be good at playing. But if you do all the other stuff, you know, selling things and, you know, going on, you know, selling a, you know, if you go on a Sky and you walk up to the camera with the kind of funny look and go, hey, but if you score a goal and you point to your name at the back, you're playing the game. If you play that game and you get advisors and you're selling Rolexes, you're playing the game, right? If you play that game, does it cost? That's the way it is. Well, it's not fair, but that's the way it is. See if you don't play the game. See if you let one matter. See if you see what you walked, saw one matter or something like walking in to Marks and Spencer's, would you bat an eyelid? No, you wouldn't. You would bat an eyelid if you've seen Cristiano Ronaldo get into it. There's more choices there than people give credit for. I had choices. I could have lived a very different type of life, and I decided not to. I decided on as close to normality as I possibly could get. Now, to be honest, now and again, to argue against myself, somebody might pull a knife on you, which happened to me a couple of times. But normality is absolutely possible. The bit that gets me is within that sphere, there's a certain amount of players, and not all, but a certain amount of players moan and groan, but want all the posters with it, but don't take the fact that, wait a minute, if you go and take the huge bucks out with playing, pay that price. And I'm not, that's what I said, we had the chat before, and I said the word respect, as soon as I hear a player saying, oh, where's my respect? Shut up, you're kicking a ball around a minute. So I'm kind of like, I think I really should be on the, in the stands, in the terraces most of the time, because I think I've got that sort of attitude, and I've never changed it. So maybe a little bit harder, because there's a little bit more time spent on television. Well, I've spent 20 years there being on television all the time in Scotland. Like, I was like, you know, as well known a face as Alan Hansen is in England and Scotland. Still did an absolutely normal life and didn't change me a bit. So I think it can be done.
I think it can be done. I remember seeing a lot of Xabi Alonso between 2005 and 2009 at things or in a bar late at night, and being able to sort of pull it off, blend into the background a little bit, enjoy himself in the process of it. I think it can be done. Where I think it's tricky for some, and I think that these players often have a lot in common. I'm a really extreme example is the terrible time for 5 years or so Raheem Sterling had about anything that he does from the press, that anyone's looking for a little thing for some of the players, and we are talking about the very, very high profile ones, yeah, who do end up with a bit of a target on the back, and that always seems a bit unfair. And
with I agree with that, but that's the profile.
And it's something different to profile. And in the book, there's a fascinating chapter. It's reminiscent of something recently where Jurgen Klopp spoke out about the Liverpool supporters using the Rent Boys song when mm-hmm. Liverpool played Chelsea and saying it's homophobic. And Klopp did an elongated video with Paul and Anne from Liverpool's LGBTQ group, Cop Outs. And it was a really good thing to do. But Klopp's attitude was, you've been singing this song, it upsets people, stop singing the song, the song's got to go. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot, I think, for people in football to at times criticise supporters. You did it whilst at Chelsea, very early on in your career, about racial abuse towards both opposition players but also own teammates, and you come under a lot of pressure after you do it. You know, you depict the internal pressure you come over, but you were prepared to do that, and you were prepared to have that argument from a very early age.
Yes, I was prepared to do it. A better way to do it is, I wasn't prepared not to do it. There is no way I could not do it. That was the thing. Because of my personality, because of my background, I couldn't stand there, play, and just ignore the fact that there was these tens of thousands of people making racist comments. And it didn't matter if it was my player, anyone else's player, whatever. I just couldn't deal with it. And I've got this kind of ultra-fairness thing just through my life where I don't care if you're, you know, black, white, gay, straight, Muslim, Christian, anything, anything, anything. It's just about being a decent-ish person. And the fact that you should be in any way discriminated or abused for any of those things, I have no time for. And there's a lot of people that, you know, do want to take sides, and it makes life easier to take sides and be part of a gang that are taking sides. I think there's a lack of bravery in that, and I think there's a smallness in that. So I couldn't do that. I just couldn't be like that person. It's interesting you should say I was put under a lot of pressure. You're right. They tried to put me under pressure. They failed miserably to put me under pressure. I just went, shut up, you're talking rubbish. I know better than you. Now, to do that, and do you know when you say something, here's an analogy, here's a great analogy, I love this. There was, if you say something and then 30 years later, people think it's the norm, and you think, yeah, did you not notice I said that back then? You know, did you not notice I was kind of quite loud and I was the only one? But no one rarely, very rarely do people go back and say that, you know, but it doesn't matter because you do it for the right reasons. Fortunately, I've two groups did notice, by the way, and that's why I'm Dr. Nevin. I have two doctors because not for the football, but for starting the anti-racism campaigns in football, at least one or some people noticed. But there is not a smugness, but there is a feeling that when you stick to your guns and you act the right way, and then somewhere down the line, the society changes and realizes, oh, we had to mature. It's a great thing. So there is an entire chapter in the book about, you know, how people are dealing with, you know, sexuality, you know, and I happen to be straight, you know, but I got it quite a bit. Oh, you mean whatever. I'll not use the words, but you can see, you know what they are. And I would turn around and go, well, I'm not, but I don't care if you think it. Does it make me a bad person if I was? And I just was dead comfortable with that. Okay, so I had a girlfriend at the time, so that didn't affect me. Do you know my favourite one? Can I tell you this free story? My favourite one was I haven't got to do with any of that, but it's just been right afterwards. I went to Chelsea a few years back and I said to him, look, because I worked down there quite a bit. I said, still to TV and stuff like that. And I said, I've got a player for you. I think you should buy him. It's good cost about 10 million, but just buy him. And they went, oh, who is it? I told them the name. No, we've looked at him. He makes mistakes. And I went, yes, he's bored. He's too good for where he is. And they went, oh, no, we're not taking him. So I went to my mate, David Moyes, who had just taken over at Man United. And I said, David, honestly, got this guy. You've got to get this guy. It's brilliant. You've got to get him. He'll really help you. Because he was just building up Man United, trying to get a foothold in Man United. And Moise went, thought about it, but no, he makes mistakes. I'm going, yes, he's bored. Anyway, Virgil van Dijk eventually. And I told them all, going, you've got to get this guy. He's unbelievable. You know, and he then goes to Southampton, obviously, and the rest is history. But there is that feeling of every now and again you see it. Say things and you think, I'm saying this now, no one's agreeing with me, but I'm pretty damn confident it's right. And it's a good thing to feel, particularly if it's a cultural thing, you know, and certainly some of the stuff that I've talked about. Now, if I was worried about one thing before the book came out, I only had one concern, I promise you. One line in the book worried me, and you'd never guess it in a million years.
Go on.
So this book was finished before the first lockdown. First lockdown, that's how long it takes to get a book out, right? And I wasn't worried about the timing because it's kind of a bit timeless, you know, it's in the past. But there was one line in it I said, I was talking about homophobia and that there hasn't been any out players apart from Justin Fashion. And I was saying, do you know what? It's going to be okay. It's going to be fine. When the next... a big name player comes out in Britain, you'll get some stick from the services, you'll get some stick online. You know what? The game will be fine. In fact, the game will be ultra cool. And all the way through from writing that to 2 years to the day it came out, I was thinking, I do want somebody to come out, but I don't want them to come out before the book comes out because I want me to be able to say, told you, it's going to be okay. It will be fine. And so no sort of gay players come out yet. I just hope it's soon. Because it will just normalise all that. And the analogy I used at the time is, I watch a lot of women's football, right? Do you know how many gay players are in that game? Loads of them. Do you know how much stuff they give? None. So that's, we've got to get that. That's one of the steps. And there's lots of steps, but that's one of the ones we've got to kind of bring in century, man.
Could not agree more. Pat, just you mentioned, you happened to just mention an offhand way. So this book effectively ends when you leave Everton and you move into playing for Tranmere. There's a lot of excitement about you going on loan to Tranmere, how much you enjoy it. I love the story you're coming back, telling everyone. You'll believe how good these players are after you get there and how much you're enjoying your training. But you are working on a follow-up from this that covers the rest of your career, given everything that you've done in the post-football context. That is following this one.
Not exactly right. Two slight errors with that. One, which you know, I sent the final copy this morning to the publishers, so I'm not working on it. It's done. Sent this morning. So part two is done. It doesn't deal with my post-career, really.
All right.
It deals with the period of time from going to Tranmere, being PFA chairman, a period of time at Kilmarnock, then I was player stroke chief executive at Motherwell. And that was an extraordinary period of time. Now, it's not got the crash bang wallop of Everton and Chelsea, which would draw a lot of people in, but this one has, because this one, fortunately, is actually, they tell me it's done very well. I don't know what very well means, but they're very pleased with it. But I'll be honest with you, I was desperate to do the next one. And I'll tell you the secret now. I started writing and I got to the end of Tranmere and I gave it to the publisher. But I didn't stop writing. I just kept going. So it's not as if it's a separate thing. It almost, the next sentence just starts and it goes on. But it is a very, very different, and this might surprise you, a much weirder story. Really, really weird story after that, because the things that happen after that are quite extraordinary, because it's a different type of football, and I loved writing the second part, but you know, the first one, there was a real joy in it, and the second one, you know, as you get older, you know, some things in life, as you suggested earlier on, do change. You have to look at it in a different way. And maybe that's among the most interesting things, that could I possibly keep that same attitude that I had when life does change like that. And it's harder. It is harder. Particularly, there's one scene, well, I'll not tell you the whole of it, but I'm sitting watching the telly one night, right? And I'm chairman of the PFA. And you're sitting there and having a glass of wine, and you're talking to your wife, and the Man United are playing, and they're watching a game. It's really enjoyable. And then Eric Cantona goes and drop kicks one of the supporters, and you think, you've just ruined my life. Everybody else is aghast, and I'm going, oh my God, the next 6 weeks of my life are going to be a disaster. And because I need to deal with, I'm chairman of the PFA, I'm his representative. And it was like, so things like that would happen, which, and I'm still playing as well. So, you know, it's been great doing this. It's been a brilliant thing that I've been able to get a chance to write. If anybody's got any ideas of a second name for the second book, because I've not come up with a name yet.
Text in if you've got any ideas for the name of Pat's second book. It's been an absolute pleasure. It is called The Accidental Footballer. It's excellent. It really is. All the places where you can get books from, you can get this one from. It's done very well. We hear live, hot off the presses there from Pat. Be involved with it, doing very well. Get yourself a copy. Enjoy, Pat. It has been an absolute pleasure.
An absolute pleasure talking to everyone as well. And if you do end up getting it, buying it, or listen to it on Audible, which I read, and yes, I did do it slowly so you can understand my accent, I just hope you enjoy it. That's why I did it, so people could enjoy it. Sports Social Podcast Network.